This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. South Korea and China are each reporting hundreds more virus cases Thursday as the new illness persists in the worst-hit areas and spreads beyond borders. In Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump says his administration is ready for the virus, whether many or only a few people are infected.
But we're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're at that very low level.
Mr. Trump put Vice President Mike Pence in charge of handling the administration's response to the virus. Pence says all the resources available will be used to protect the American public.
My role will be to continue to bring that team together, to bring to the president the best options for action, to see to the safety and well-being and health of the American people.
The Trump administration has asked for $2.5 billion to fight the virus, a figure many in Congress think is too low. More than 80,000 people worldwide have been infected with the virus, and nearly 3,000 have died. A gunman opened fire Wednesday at Milwaukee's Molson Coors Brewery complex, killing five people before taking his own life. The gunman was identified as a 51-year-old Milwaukee man employed by the company. Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee.
There was a horrific shooting that has occurred. We're urging all residents and people in this area to stay away from this area simply because of traffic diversions and things like that.
Before Wednesday's shooting, there had been three mass killings nationwide in 2020, with 12 total victims. All have been shootings. For more on any of today's top news, go to voanews.com. You're listening to VOA News. A federal appeals court is siding with the Trump administration stand on grant money for so-called sanctuary cities. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The ruling by the Second Circuit in Manhattan says the administration can hold back law enforcement grants to force states to cooperate with immigration enforcement. It reverses a lower court's decision ordering the administration to release funding to New York City and seven states. Federal appeals courts in Chicago, Philadelphia, and San Francisco have ruled against the federal government in similar cases. The Justice Department called the decision a major victory for Americans. The American Civil Liberties Union says this is the government's attempt to bully, cajole, and coerce state and local governments to participate in federal immigration enforcement. Ed Donahue, Washington.
A hospital official in New Delhi says at least 20 people have been killed in the Indian capital during violent clashes between Hindu and Muslim groups over a new citizenship law. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
New Delhi police used tear gas and smoke grenades to disperse stone-throwing crowds. Hospital officials told Reuters they had treated over 200 people since the fighting first intensified on Monday, many suffering severe injuries. Prime Minister Narendra Modi broke his silence on the matter on Wednesday, appealing for peace between Hindus and Muslims. The law, announced by Modi's nationalist government, makes it easier for non-Muslims from neighboring countries to gain Indian citizenship. It has reignited long-standing tensions between the country's Hindu and minority Muslim groups.
That is Reuters' Soraya Ali reporting. Five-time Grand Slam tennis champion Maria Sharapova, who became one of the highest-paid women in all of sports, has announced her retirement at the age of 32. AP's Jennifer King reports.
Maria Sharapova burst onto the scene at 17 when she won Wimbledon in 2004 and gathered five Grand Slam titles. With her blonde hair and trademark grunt, Sharapova was as big a star as tennis had, making millions of dollars in sponsorship deals. Sharapova's rivalry with Serena Williams was supposed to be one for the ages, but it became so one-sided it can hardly be called a rivalry, with Sharapova winning just two of her 22 battles with Williams. Sharapova suffered a serious shoulder injury in 2008 and was dogged by injuries to her thigh, wrist, and shoulder. She hinted at leaving at the Australian Open in 2019.
You realize that you're not immortal. You're never going to play this for forever.
In an essay written for Vanity Fair and Vogue about her decision to retire, she asked, "How do you leave behind the only life you've ever known?" I'm Jennifer King.
A mixed day on Wall Street as jitters about the spreading of the coronavirus made investors nervous. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped 0.46%. The S&P 500 fell 0.38%. But the NASDAQ gained 0.17%. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. Embassy in Togo urges the Elections Commission to make public results from all polling stations.
This statement is quite good news for us because our candidate, Mr. Adeyemi, had asked before for this publication of the results for each polling station in view of transparency.
Bridget Ajamagbo is the spokesperson for Togolese opposition coalition candidate Abayomi Kojo. Two Malawi opposition parties hold talks for a possible alliance. Al-Shabaab militants have killed 42 teachers in northeastern Kenya in the past 5 years. Kenya, for the first time, allows an informal visit of a UN envoy on extrajudicial killings. And residents of Sudan's war-torn Darfur welcome former President Bashir's possible ICC trial.
He says handing Bashir to the International Criminal Court could achieve justice and also build confidence between the warring groups in peace talks, the victims of genocide and historical repression.
That's reporter Namba Muhideen in Khartoum, and a Zimbabwe economics graduate says the situation in Wuhan, China is getting desperate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition coalition led by its candidate Abayomi Kojo says it welcomes the U.S. Embassy statement calling on the Togolese Electoral Commission to make public results of all polling stations, particularly those being contested by the opposition, so as to ensure transparency. In a statement Wednesday, the embassy congratulated the Togolese people for a peaceful election. The opposition says it won the election, although the Election Commission declared President Fona Simbe the winner. Bridget Ajamagbo, spokesperson for opposition coalition candidate Kojo, says the U.S. Embassy statement is good news because the opposition has been demanding for results of all polling stations to be published.
First, they congratulated Togolese people for this vote. They said everybody went to vote peacefully. And then they were appealing to the government to ensure that the results that have already been published and that are contested by Kojo, our candidate, they are asking the government to ensure that those results, they are published for each polling station to ensure transparency. Finally, James, they regret the fact that some civil society groups which applied for observation of the election have been denied the right to observe because of government, they didn't tell them that these groups are supported by the NDI. And then the government discovered that the groups supported by NDI, and they said, we do not give you the right to observe. And the statement regrets this position from the government.
What does that mean
and
now for your party?
This statement, it's quite good news for us because our candidate, Mr. Adeyemi, had asked before for this publication of the results for each polling station in view of transparency. We are sure that the results that have been published 3 days ago, they don't conform with what we have. And according to what we have, our candidate is the winner of the election, and we consider that he is the elected president of Togo.
Do you think the government is going to do what the U.S. Embassy is asking for? And what if the government doesn't? Because the government said that President Fona Simbe won the election by 72%.
It's a lie. They can never win the election at 72%. Because a large majority of Togolese people do not want for this government again. We want them to live into power. So they can't vote for him. And if the government knows that what he published is true, he has to give this evidence by conforming to the recommendation of the African Embassy. It's very simple. They say they've won to make wrong that what they said is the truth, Then they have now to publish in detail the results, and everybody will see.
Bridget Ajamagbo is the spokesperson for Togolese opposition coalition candidate Abayomi Kojo. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lome. In Malawi, the leader of the opposition United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, Solos Chilima, says he is willing to enter into an alliance with anyone as long as he and that person are on a common cause. This comes a day after President Peter Mutharika and his ruling Progressive Democratic Party, the DPP, enter into an alliance with the United Democratic Front, the UDF party, for the May 19 constitutional court order presidential election. There have been rumors that the UTM and the Malawi Congress Party of Lazarus Chakwera have been holding talks for a possible alliance. UTM spokesperson Joseph Chidante Malunga says the UTM has formed a task force to engage the Malawi Congress Party.
Our president has made it very clear that we need to listen to the views of the people. I think the people out there are saying, why don't we consider this? But I think before we make a decision, we need to have a thorough understanding of what is an alliance and several other dynamics within the alliance we need to understand. So that's why we have formed a team, like a task force, from our side that will engage our counterparts in the Malawi Congress Party to begin talking.
So how soon, how much time do you have before the people of Malawi know that, yes, there's going to be this alliance?
There isn't much time, considering that the parliament has set May 19th as the date for the polls, and by law we have 60 days before that for campaign, so which means campaign is going to start on 20th or 19th of March. So we have like 2 weeks from now. So before we get into campaign, people have to know. So all these things that we're talking about have to finalize before maybe 10th March, thereabout.
I saw an article where President Mutharika, I think he made a comment to say he is going to win now more than 50 plus one.
he's entitled to his opinion. But I think it's all out of desperation. I mean, why didn't he win 50 plus 1 before? These elections that we were disputing, he got 30%, if that is anything to go with. So how come he's going to get 50 plus 1 this time when the person that he has pulled, he got less than 200,000 votes, which if you put together, are not going to be even 40%.
Are you talking about Atupele and the party that has formed the alliance?
Yes, he's pulled Atupele. Atupele got about 200,000 votes. If you take 200,000 votes and lump them on the Mutharika, there is no way they can get the 50 plus ones.
One thing that I think has led to downfall of coalition building in Africa has been the inability of one party to give way to the other. It seems like that whenever a coalition be mentioned or something, one of the parties want to insist to be president. In this case, do you think your leader, Mr. Chilima, and Mr. Chakwera, can they reach a compromise in terms of who can be on top of the ticket?
Yeah, we are fully aware of that. Indeed, that's one of the issues that, you know, leads to these alliances to not working the way they're supposed to be. But I think as UTM, what we have said, before we even start sharing positions, because if you start sharing positions, then you are going to miss the whole point. What we're saying is, can we put the interests of Malawians first and find out from the people what is it that people want us to do? If we exhaust those issues, then the issues of who is going to be number one, who is going to be number two, I don't think they're going to be issues.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesperson for the United Transformation Movement Party, led by Vice President Solos Chilima. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 27. Daybreak Africa time, 14:30 past the hour. Sudan's decision this month that former officials, including ousted President Omar al-Bashir, would face trial in the International Criminal Court has been welcomed by people in the war-torn Darfur region. The charges against Bashir and three others include genocide and war crimes committed in Darfur after civil war broke out there in 2003. But Sudanese officials have also indicated that the trial might not take place in The Hague. Naba Muhideen reports from South Sudan.
Muhammad Issa was 12 years old when militias attacked his village in Eastern Darfur 10 years ago, killing his father and cousins and forcing the rest of the family to flee for their lives. He has been living for the past decade in Western Sudan's Kalma camp, the largest in Darfur for internally displaced people, with an estimated 500,000 residents. Like most victims of the war in Darfur, Issa blames former President Omar al-Bashir's government for the conflict, which the UN says has left around 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced since 2003. The war that broke out in Darfur between the Sudanese government and three rebel groups quickly turned ethnic as mainly Arab militias targeted black Africans. But peace is slowly returning to Darfur as rebels and the government have engaged in talks. During peace talks with Darfur rebels on February 11, the Sudanese delegations agreed that all those wanted by the ICC should be handed over to stand trial for genocide and war crimes charges in Darfur. For the displaced like Issa, seeing Bashir on trial at the ICC would bring some comfort to families like his. He says handing Bashir to the International Criminal Court could achieve justice and also build confidence between the warring groups in peace talks, the victims of genocide and historical repression, not to mention the refugees and displaced people, says Issa, could feel justice if Bashir goes on trial. The ICC charged Bashir with crimes in Darfur in 2009, but Sudan refused to recognize the court's authority. Sudanese officials have indicated while the trial might be in front of the ICC, it might not take place in The Hague. Information Minister Faisal Salih told the Reuters news agency handing over Bashir was one option. Another option would be the ICC coming to Sudan, he said, or the two forming a hybrid court. One of Bashir's lawyers, Zain al-Abdin Muhammad, argues Sudan's courts should have jurisdiction and are qualified to handle any cases related to Darfur. If there is any accusations against the former president, he says, the trial should be in Sudan, and there is an independent judiciary system. The alleged crimes in the Darfur conflict, including genocide and war crimes, are included in Sudanese law, says Muhammad. Binding Sudan to the International Criminal Court is not a legal issue, but a political one, he says, and they will legally resist it. Bashir's supporters have protested handing him to the ICC, saying it would be against Sudan's sovereignty and the dignity of the army, which Bashir commanded for three decades. Military officers in Sudan's transitional government served in the Darfur conflict and stand accused of rights abuses. General Mohamed Hamdan Daglu, a former brigade commander in the Janjaweed militia that is accused of mass killings and rape in Darfur, is the deputy chairman of Sudan's ruling sovereign council. The Sudanese Professional Association, SPA, which led the protest against Bashir's rule, argues Sudan's laws and courts are not fit to prosecute the former president or others for war crimes. Bashir, who was ousted by the military in April after a month of protest, has already faced trial in Sudan and in December was sentenced to just 2 years in prison for corruption. For Darfur's displaced victims like Issa, the ICC may be their only hope for justice. Neba Muhiddin for VOA News, South Darfur, Sudan.
42 teachers from northeastern Kenya have been killed by the militia group Al-Shabaab in the past 5 years, according to the Kenyan Teachers Service Commission. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the commission says non-local teachers in the region are not safe and as such have withdrawn their services.
Non-local teachers working in northeastern parts of the country have been camping outside the Teachers Service Commission in Nairobi for a while until their plea not to work in the region was heard. And yesterday, Wednesday, the Teachers Service Commission maintained that it will not post teachers to northeastern if the insecurity situation is not fixed. Speaking before the Parliamentary Education Committee, Commission's Chief Executive Officer Nancy Masharia told the legislatures that the right to life supersedes the right to education and called on the government to improve security in the region.
In the last 5 years, we have lost 42 teachers. These attacks are sporadic. Then I think the other one that he asked about us is teachers that why we withdrew teachers. Chair, I think again I answered, we did not withdraw teachers. In fact, as we speak, if you look at our table, we have local teachers still in the northeastern region.
The commission had already withdrawn some teachers from the region and urging leaders to encourage more of the locals to train as teachers so they don't need to demand for non-local teachers. Education Cabinet Secretary George Magoha said that while the matter of transfer is affecting locals, it's a fact that innocent Kenyans have died in the northern parts of the country and the targeting of non-locals can't be downplayed.
A very cunning omission of the facts that teachers died, Kenyans died, and those Kenyans died there, and he knows, and it would have been better if it was also included in his presentation. Policy of government is to treat every child exactly the same way and to provide that child with security and to make sure that teachers are posted to all parts and corners of this country. That is the government policy, and that's what I'm supposed to implement.
On the other hand, Inspector General of Police Hilary Mutyambai said that the government will deploy more police officers in Northeastern in the next 2 months, despite the fact that they have also lost a large number of police officers in the area during the intervention.
We have to work with the locals. The leaders have to talk to their people, and the people work with the security for us to be able to root out the sympathizers and the local element who are assisting Al-Shabaab to target those people considered are not from that place.
Northeastern Kenya, especially in the counties of Wajir, Mandera and Garissa, have been a hotbed of terror, claiming hundreds of lives ranging from locals, non-locals and security officers. And however much, the commission is insisting on withdrawing teachers from the area. Employment and Labor Relations Court Judge Helen Wasilwa has stopped the move temporarily following a successful application by Hussein Riaro, who claims the massive transfer is discriminatory because it affects some areas in the region that have not experienced terror-related issues. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Kenya has for the first time allowed the informal visit of a UN envoy on extrajudicial, summary or arbitrary executions. Agnes Kaluma, a French human rights expert, met with relatives of police killings in Nairobi slums, where hundreds of cases have left relatives and friends of victims feeling powerless. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
60-year-old Efa Kwendo lost two of her eight children in 2018, just months apart, when police in broad daylight shot them dead. She admits her sons got into some trouble, but she says it was nothing that would warrant the use of lethal force.
Apo si Robert ajawai shikwa aende kusimama kotini. Ajawai fungwa.
She says Robert had never been arrested or taken to jail. No one ever called to tell me he had been arrested or taken someone's car. All I know is that my son had a temper. If you wronged him, he would beat you up. Even my second son, there was nothing major he had done. Maybe getting into little fights here and there. The deaths are just two of hundreds of cases of police killings that Kenyan rights groups have documented. This month, a coalition of Kenyan rights groups reported police last year alone killed 107 people, most of them young, poor men in slums, shot to death under suspicious circumstances. Reninga Mao sits on the board of Amnesty International Kenya.
When we stop recognizing these deaths, these extrajudicial killings, when we say that nothing is changing and therefore we will not document it, we acquiesce to these killings.
Rights group accused Kenya's independent policing oversight authority of not doing enough to stop the killings. IPOA says 142 cases from last year are under investigation, but admits only six police officers have been sent to the public prosecutor, who says few witnesses are willing to come forward. Nurdin Haji is Kenya's director of public prosecutions.
We have community outreach and we are reaching out to a lot of these communities who are being affected by this problem and trying to sensitize them and trying to ask them to be more bold in terms of giving us the evidence. We are trying to make them understand their rights to access justice and how they can do that.
Kenya this month for the first time allowed the informal visit of the UN's envoy on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, Agnes Kalamad. She met relatives of police victims in Nairobi and Mombasa, and she called on Kenyan authorities to do more.
When after this killing there is no investigation, there is no prosecution, and there is no justice, that's a second killing. And that killing is a killing of our society. Impunity kills our society.
Relatives of victims hope the UN envoy's visit will help advance the wheels of justice. Meanwhile, Kenyan activists say they'll keep documenting and publishing police killings until they no longer have to do so. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Zimbabwe economics graduate, Blessing Chirima, says the situation in Wuhan, China, which is the epicenter of the coronavirus, is getting desperate, with prices of basic commodities skyrocketing and most students becoming destitute as their bank accounts are running dry. Chirima graduated in January and was due to return to Zimbabwe before she was caught up in the coronavirus lockdown. Chirima says she and other Zimbabweans in China are appealing to the Harare government for financial assistance to buy food and other basic necessities.
The situation, I can say, is really tough here in Wuhan, not only as the students, but for also our fellow Zimbabweans who have been working here in Wuhan. They have been working for themselves so that they can cater for their food, staff, and some other things. But you find out that now it's difficult for them. They are not working. They are not doing anything. And it's really difficult for them to make ends meet. It's really difficult for them to get money to buy some food stuff. And also food is now expensive.
Take us through your day-to-day activities. What do you do daily since this coronavirus was announced a pandemic? And also, are you now allowed to move freely?
I'm not even allowed to move. I'm always indoors. Each and every day, I woke up, I eat, and I'm just indoors. I don't go anywhere. The only thing I can do is to be in here. And, you know, because of this situation, you end up panicking, you know, and it's so bad. The only thing you can do is to just stay indoors, nothing else.
At the moment, how are the other foreigners from other African countries holding up? How many Zimbabweans would you say are there?
For the Zimbabweans, I can say maybe roughly 350 to 400. Concerning some other people from some other countries, I can say the situation is just the same for us all. But for some other countries, you can see that they are receiving help from their government and from maybe their fellow countrymates, I can say. So if they have such kind of help, I can say we really thank God for them because it's really helpful. But when it comes to a situation like us, the Zimbabweans, you can see that things are very tough because right now I'm just surviving, receiving money from home. And it was good before. It was good because before things were really cheap, like foodstuffs. But now you find that foodstuffs are very, very expensive. So, like, it's really good if we can really have help maybe from the government or from some other fellow Zimbabweans.
That was Blessing Chirima, a Zimbabwean based in Wuhan, China, speaking with reporter Marvelous Nyahui of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Briefly before we leave you, summary of Africa news. Togo's opposition coalition, led by its candidate Abayomi Kojo, said it welcomes a U.S. embassy statement calling on the Togolese Electoral Commission to make public results of all polling stations, particularly those being contested by the opposition, so as to ensure transparency. And that is it for this Thursday, February 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.